Well, it is a great pleasure this afternoon in Cardiff to meet Matt Batten for the first time in, it must be, over 20 years.
It was, because it would have been when I was doing my Master's in Theology in Cardiff.
Trinity College.
So, yeah, over 20 years. Yeah. I know, it's bizarre.
Yeah. And so you were in Cardiff at the time and then commuting to Cardiff.
Yeah, I was. So I was living in Cardiff and I remember finishing university because I had the best time in Trinity doing my... and as an undergraduate doing RE. And that's how I think we know some of the similar people, which is such a small world. And I had such an amazing time and then knew I wanted to go and do a Master's and carry on the academic stuff. And yeah, and that's how I went back to Trinity College Carmarthen. I've just got such amazing memories of that place. I love it.
And something that I found over even the last few days, the number of connections, people who in Lampeter or in Cardiff have studied religious studies, theology, everybody knows, you know, it's that game, was it 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon?
Yeah.
I think it's 1 degree when it comes to University of Wales.
I think you are absolutely right, and particularly Lampeter and Trinity College Carmarthen, because I think what I see from your post when you meet up with people is like, oh, so they went to Lampeter, but they're my lecturer when I was doing an undergraduate, like Wendy Dossett, for example, you know? And now Edward, well, Father Edward, was in Lampeter, so that's how you know him, but now he's my local priest, and I work in the Diocese of Llandaff, so I work with him. So it's just, I find, you know, when like he friend requests me on Facebook, and then you look at similar friends, and I'm like, well, how would he know Chris Deasy? Like, you're in Kent, like, how would he? And then it's like, all right, I get it.
Well, but there's a colleague of mine who does a lot of music material, actually during lockdown, it's gone completely ballistic and got worldwide. The Marsh family, you may even have heard of them, they do all these spoof, you know, songs from the 80s and so on, but you know, with a lockdown theme. That took off during lockdown, and I noticed that a school friend of mine was one of his friends on Facebook, and we both spotted this, so we were like, what's the connection? Simply, they both went to the same university. But you find this all the time, people who went to the same school as you, it might be an infant school or a secondary school, or the same university, maybe at the same time, or there's some sort of overlap. And you discover, and this is the bit that really intrigues me, it's not just that it happened at the time that you're just reacquainting with people you knew 30 years ago, it's that you may even have been in the same place as that person. Mm. You may have had the same memories. You went to the same hypnotist show or the same film screening or the graduation ceremony.
Yeah.
You may have sat, but you always like sat on a different table or one row behind.
Yeah.
And then suddenly 30 years on, you meet for the first time and suddenly discover that it's not just, oh, let's pick up from where we left off 30 years ago. It's actually, it's starting from scratch, but we have this incredible scaffolding.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It is exactly like that, isn't it? It's fascinating.
And are you in touch with a lot of those people from your past?
I am from people in university, a lot of them, because I think I made the most amazing friends in university. It was... honestly, it was just the making of me going to university. I loved it. So I'm still really, really good friends with pretty much everyone I lived with in university, bar one person who his posts on social media were... I was like, oh, that's borderline... Actually, that's not even borderline racist. That is racist. And I'm like, do I need that in my life? Nope. Yeah. So that's gone. But everyone else, really, really good friends. But not when it comes to school. Now, I'm friends with two people that I went in school with. I've been friends on Facebook with a few others. But our lives are so different that I can't make that connection. I just went, I don't have those friendships from school. But university, like, we are still the closest we've ever been.
Yeah, and I was the same as it took me, I think, 16 years to go back to a university reunion.
Oh, right.
I think I needed to step away in order to return.
Yeah.
But for school, only in the last year or two, I think it was actually during lockdown, that I started to make some of those contacts again. Or maybe a few people reached out to me or heard some of my interviews, and then that actually set me on a journey. And I was kind of ready for it.
Yeah.
But, and I was saying to somebody I interviewed yesterday, who's also known to us, is that some of those school days, I suppose we all develop a personality and we become the people that we want to be, but we don't necessarily do that in a school environment.
No.
Certainly not in the 1980s.
No,
when
gosh, no.
It was conformity.
Absolutely,
you
know, was.
And if you didn't follow the way of doing things.
100%, yeah. I mean, the school that I went to was Bryn Terg, and it had a very strong rugby thing. So if you were, you know, any boy in there was expected to love rugby. That wasn't me. So, you know, I mean, I liked school, but I don't think it was where I became the person I am today. I think that was definitely university and meeting the people that I met. Yeah. I just look back and I think, if I hadn't have gone to the union that night, and if I hadn't had the friend who lived in that block, mm-hmm. I would not have known some of these people. But yeah, we're still incredibly close.
Well, I mentioned this in a few of my other interviews, but you probably know the film Romy and Michelle's
High School Reunion. Yeah.
That for me sums it up. So when that came out in 97, I was only 6 years out of school.
Yeah.
And I watched that and thought, I could never be different than anybody from school, because I always saw everybody as somehow looking down on me.
Oh, yeah.
They think, oh, what are you doing with your life, kind of thing. But now, so many decades have passed, and I'm in a different zone.
Yeah.
And I'm now sort of intrigued. So I know the journey that I've made.
Yeah.
And somehow I'm thinking, I'm not, what am I scared of anymore?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I've never been to a reunion. So I've never, even the university reunion, I didn't go to it. Really didn't want to go to it. And there are certain albums and music that I cannot listen to because it reminds me so much of that period that they don't sound the same. So I've not been to a reunion, and I just didn't want to revisit. And maybe I'll be different now. And I wonder if I'm ready for that now. It's been lockdown, it's been a lot of years. Mm. And I think everyone has kind of matured differently as well. And, you know, people who were married, my friends who were married, aren't always now together. So there's a lot more to catch up on that I find more intriguing than just going back and trying to relive what we were like back in the day, because I don't think I'd have the energy for that all night going out drinking kind of thing. And my friend Kat, we talk quite often, we were like, oh, we should meet up, yeah, meet up. And I'm like, should we meet up for coffee? Because like, I really don't fancy going out for drinks. She was like, oh, thank God for that. She goes, I'm usually in bed by 10.
Oh, the number of people, as they say that you always turn into your parents
at a certain
point. But I have to say, so many people who we were reminiscing even yesterday about going down the student union bar at a certain age and having those late nights. And I go to bed ridiculously late. I think everybody knows that. I do my diaries and all sorts of stuff. So I don't get that many hours sleep. But people are saying to me, oh, I'm in bed by 9:30. And I'm thinking, I'm going down the cinema.
What? No way. I'm a 9:30, read for 40 minutes, and in bed till 7 o'clock. Yeah. In the morning, and that's my routine. But
were you like that at university?
No, in university I grabbed the good times. It was like everything I had not had previously, because I didn't like going out before. And with my family, it was like my sister, my auntie, going out, and it might be a South Wales thing, going out, you know, was the thing you did. You went out on a Thursday, on a Friday. I always looked young. So going out was not that enjoyable because you're always going to get ID'd. And I remember someone... And I think when you look young, people think it's easy then to take the mick, you know, because you're there by the grace of God in that pub. They could just say, you're too young, get out, kick you out. So I never really enjoyed going out. And I wasn't boisterous, you know. I would much prefer spending my money on buying music back then, buying books. That was like the happiest time. University, and suddenly the pressure of going out was very, very different. It was going out for a laugh, not going out because you had to, because, you know, if you wanted to go into school on Monday and people say, what did you do on your weekend? If you didn't say you went out, or you weren't seen out, or you didn't go to Crossways, which is the club everyone tried to go into, then, oh, you were boring. And so I always felt that judgment on going out. You go to university, and I don't think there was that judgment. It was, you go out and you have a good time. Yeah, some didn't go out, but nobody was judging you for it. And it was all about just going out and having a good laugh with your mates. And I loved it. And I was like, this is what I enjoy. You know, suddenly the pressure is off, and you're just going out and having a good laugh. You know, and you start with pre-drinks, you start, you know, and you go out to the pub, and we all had this routine that it became such a massive part of our 3 years.
Yeah, and I think that it's because you're doing it on your own terms.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, I remember my first week at university, and even though my sister was already there, and she was doing a postgraduate course, I felt really disoriented, because suddenly, and I turned this into a positive very early on, but suddenly, because I was left to my own devices... And I was thinking, you know, I've never been in this position before.
No.
But I had to do it, and I remember being a bit upset one evening, and then suddenly I thought, this is going to work.
Yeah.
And but of course I overshot, as I do in a lot of things in life. I go way overboard. And so I don't just do it, go to the cinema once. So we're going to go every night.
I'm going to do it all the time.
And it happened at university. So I was there and I thought, this is going to work. And so I was always, I went to every lecture, but yeah. I always went out of an evening. But it's finding the right balance.
I don't think I've missed a lecture. Even though I'd gone out on the Wednesday for a right old night out, I still turned up to Wendy's lectures. Yeah. And I couldn't do it now. Yeah, I can't even drink on a school night.
Yeah.
I'd have to go into work. Can't face it. Yeah. But when you're younger, and it was fun, and Carmarthen was small enough that wherever you went, you were going to bump into people that is in your class or university. You had those pubs. So I don't know whether at that age I would have enjoyed being in a bigger city.
Was this in the 90s?
Yeah, so 96 to 99. So, we'd all start at the Coracle. Everyone seemed to start at the Coracle. And then, you'd got the Union by about 9. And Grooves was the DJ there. It's just so... I can still see it. I can still smell it. Drinking Foster's Ice and all that kind of stuff. And then on the weekend was... Right, you didn't go to the Union, but you went to Harvey's or you went to Metro's or wherever it was, or Jackson's Lane, which we used to call Wet Dog, because it had a really weird smell in there. Yeah, and we still use this language that we used when we were back there. We'd be like, oh, we should all go out to Carmarthen. And I said, I wonder if Wet Dogs is still there. And no one is surprised by that language, because it was part of our vocabulary as this really close knit of friends.
Yeah, so I'm always intrigued at how there are things that we take for granted when we just do them because they're in front of us, they're available. We didn't have social media, so there's, these days you'd always be...
Do you think, aren't you glad? I am really glad there was no social media back then. I mean, I don't think I would have been mature enough to use it, surely.
No, but also, the gift is that we didn't have it, but there's no reason now why we can't do all the postings. For example, all those old photographs.
Oh, which I've scanned, and they are all on Facebook. Trinity College, the Den and Angie years, is one of the albums. Because, Den and Angie from EastEnders, we were like, that's again, the language you develop as friends, isn't it? And we'd be like, that was the halcyon days of EastEnders, Den and Angie. Yeah. So it became our Den and Angie years. Yeah. Like this whole weird vocabulary that we had. And so I've scanned all those photos in, and when you go back and look at them when they come up on memories, oh my goodness, the comments are hilarious because you just reminisce about the most amazing times. And that is the joy of social media, though, isn't it? The connections that you make.
Because I found early on when I started using Facebook that, of course, it would always give you all these memories.
Yeah.
And it would tell you that 1 year earlier or whatever it was, or if you put in your date of birth or something, then it would give that as an anniversary. And then I started to see the advantage in this because you could then create your own catalogue, a memory bank really, and then strategically just use it. So if somebody ever says to me now, have you got a picture from when you were at school, or well, of course, because I scanned all of those,
exactly,
then I've got them to hand.
Yeah,
so in a funny way, we didn't have social media in those days, but I've got enough material to be able to piece together that segment of my life.
Well, because we didn't have mobile phones or anything, we all, every Wednesday afternoon, instead of doing which was like the sports afternoon, wasn't it? And we were all like, we're not doing sports. We'll go into town and buy what we need for the night out, which was usually go down to Tesco's, buy a bottle of Lambrini, whatever it was back then, or Hooch. But always, always buy a disposable camera. And so like 32 photos or 24? Yes. I can't remember. I think you could go big and get like a 32er. And then the next day you get your true print envelope, stick it in there. If anyone young is listening to this, they're going to be like, what is this about? And then you send it off to true print. And then like 2 weeks' time, you get your photos back. And do you remember the three little photos you'd get on the side of the photo as well?
Yes, I do.
You'd have your main one and then those, which you gave to your friends.
Yeah.
And it was like trading cards, like I've still got those random ones where we ripped it off the photo to give it to someone else.
But it's funny you say that, because what I remember is the excitement of waiting for your photographs to be developed. And of course, the odd occasion when you realised that you hadn't spooled it correctly. and there are a couple of films that I've lost, so all these memories.
100%.
And there are people who are never captured on film.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you'd get them developed from boots. So you'd wait those. I suppose if you were in the city, you could do them in an hour. If it was in Lampeter, you'd have to wait for the 24-hour or maybe the week-long service. So you get the photographs back. You'd go in every day.
Yeah.
The excitement of waiting for those pictures. And then, of course, you had to share them. So I'd be going around the library and looking to see if my friends were there and then saying, hi, I've just had my photos developed. You're in one of them. Do you want to see them kind of thing?
Oh, no, exactly.
And it was beautiful.
It was amazing. And you'd take them to your lectures with you as well because that's where you'd meet some of the people and you'd be like, oh, look at you in this photo. And we've got some absolute corkers of dances and we look at them and we're like, oh, well, we were doing the Spice Girls dance to that one because look at what we're doing. Or we'd made up dance moves because on a Wednesday afternoon, Steps was big and all that. So we'd buy the CD single and they'd have the Steps moves inside the inlay. And we'd all, at that point we were sober, practice our dance moves, ready to go out and do when we got to the Union. Mm. And then it was a whole other ball game at the end of the night when you're trying to do these dance. And we've got the photos of it. It's genius.
Somebody pointed out to me that when we look back on all those photographs, they always, always seem to be related to evenings out. There's lots of stuff of people out in the Union bar or the equivalent places.
Yeah.
But perhaps not so much. I suppose there are people who put things in their rooms. But did you find that? Did you find that it's always those sort of special occasions, like the Friday night,
and
you'd film those, but you didn't necessarily, for example, nobody ever posts a picture, and obviously there are good reasons why that's the case, of your lectures or your lecturers.
I don't think I've got any photos in a classroom back then. Yeah. I've got photos in our halls, in where we lived in the house. I've got photos of us when we were sunbathing outside Non, one of the blocks there. But I've got nothing, but I remember clearly every classroom. I remember where we were when we'd go to Wendy's Buddhism lectures. I can remember going for food. I know where I was when Vaughan Salisbury was teaching mission, and I first heard the word paradigm. Still there. I can still recall it. I can still remember it. And I can remember walking in, to the where I lived in Noakes, and I can still remember the walls and the carpet and everything.
And
so vivid.
It's actually not that different now, because students never ask me, I suppose it's the sacred ground in the same way that you wouldn't just go to a funeral and start taking a photograph.
That's an interesting...
You just know that something's... It's the appropriateness of the space.
But don't you go to a conference and take photos there?
And do you know what? You've mentioned that. Now, I remember running a conference in 2019, so a few months before lockdown, and I filmed every speaker.
Yeah.
And I posted them all publicly on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I sort of got their permissions and they knew I was doing it. But also I didn't want to push it in case somebody said no.
Yeah.
I wanted the whole collection of everything. Now, that's interesting because we'll do that for those special events.
Yeah.
But now that we record our own lectures, and during lockdown I was obviously videoing, so my face would appear on Teams or Zoom or whatever. So I'm now used to being seen giving lectures.
Gotcha.
But prior to that, there was no, maybe occasionally audio recording, but certainly no pictures of me delivering a teaching event. So you'd remember, in my case, I have the most phenomenal memories of, as you do, of going to lectures at university. But we have no images. The only images we have in many cases are those evening out type social events.
You are spot on, actually. And I wouldn't think, even now, when I'm doing my a master's in digital theology, and I've been to when we had the one meetup in person, and I didn't take any photos of the classroom even now, even though if I went to a communications conference, and I go to quite a lot for the job, I'll take photos of the speaker and post on Twitter. And I used to live tweet all the time, but I've stopped doing that now when I was the one presenting, and I look out and I can see people are on their phones. And as someone who was standing up on there, I was like, I'd rather them pay attention, actually. And actually, am I paying money to go to a conference, being there at the same time and in the same space as people, but actually I'm not paying attention to them. All I'm doing is showing the 3,000-4,000 people who follow me on Twitter, hey, look where I am. And I'm being the expert live rather than listening to someone. And I've changed my opinion now, even when I go to gigs. Whereas before, I would take clips and video clips all the time of pretty much every song, every photo. And now I don't, because I remember a DJ saying, why do people take their phone out and film? Why don't they just go to the gig and experience it and feel it? Because most of the time, unless you're a really good photographer, all you get is a tiny person on the stage and loads of lights. Yeah. So what am I trying to put on social media here? Is it just saying, hey, look at me, I went to this gig? Because those photos aren't amazing photos.
No.
And that's made me rethink now why I take photos when I go to events. So I've stopped live tweeting at conferences. I do take photos at gigs, but not as many as I used to, and one or two video clips. And that is really because I've got a big group of people who like rock music, and I love seeing who they're going to see and discovering music. It's not the best quality, but I'll still post it. But I've even started questioning why I do selfies all the time.
Yeah.
Not in my personal life, because that's fine, it's fun. But in my day job, so director of comms in Diocese of Llandaff, I was going around taking photos of me in a parish with the priest or with a volunteer. Hey, I had a great time at this place. And I start thinking, well, what am I just showing? Am I showing off here? Am I saying, hey, look how busy I am going around the diocese meeting all these people? And now I'm wondering, now I'm making a more of a conscious effort of taking me out of the narrative. So it's not about me going to these places, but I'm still there taking photos and taking photos of someone, just not necessarily being the one in the selfie and saying, hey, it's me.
Yeah, that's actually really revealing, because in my case, because we often joke, because I've got young children, but I go to the cinema all the time, but I never post pictures of my children anyway. No. That's a separate issue. But I'll often say, for example, I'm here at the zoo with my children, but all you see is me.
Yeah.
And there are reasons for that. Yeah. But the interesting thing is that it's almost as though I'm kind of future-proofing. I don't know who's... I mean, maybe no one will ever be interested.
Yeah.
However, because I retrospectively wish I had more of a record of things I did in the past,
yes,
it's almost like, well, I can't do much about that. I can't, you know, create memories or pictures from 30 years ago, but I can start now.
Yeah.
So I've gone into overdrive, and I will do all those selfies. But also, it's almost like a compliment, in the complement, not compliment, yeah, in the sense that if I'm looking at a film, and I'll put up a review of the film, to have that picture of me by the film poster, sort of, then it contextualises it.
Absolutely.
So there is a point to it.
But it's also your thing.
Yeah.
Like, if I think, if I was to define what your thing is on social media, your thing is film, and your film is, if you go into the cinema, you take a photo of you by the poster. I really like it, because I watch a lot of films, and I'm really interested in what you go and watch. And you don't post reviews now on Facebook.
No, well, and I have a reason for that, because for 3-4 years, I was up like 500-word reviews, that sort of thing. And a few people said to me, this is great, but is that the right place to put them? Because what I was conscious of is a lot of people will just do their one line or put up some photographs and say, hey, we're having a nice evening out. And there's me putting a quite sort of a serious, and you know, I put research into that, a review of 600 words, whatever it might be. And I kind of got it that maybe I should create a designated site.
Ah, okay.
Or maybe, you know, sort of do it properly. So I've never got around to doing that, but I still do the reviews.
Ah, okay.
Oh, so I've got reviews, that probably hundreds.
I think that's a shame. Because as someone who follows you on Facebook, I perhaps wouldn't necessarily think to go to a website to read your reviews. But because they're there in my feed, and because I am very interested in film, and particularly the ones that you go and review as well, because you see things really interestingly, I would read it, so I miss it that you don't post it. And I can understand what people are saying, these are so good, why don't you put them somewhere for a wider audience? But then you've also curated a really good audience of people who follow you on social media. And so I really like those reviews. It's the same with Tristan Hughes, who we both know. Like, I really enjoy his blogs when he writes them. I wish he would do more, and I know he's busy and everything. But, you know, I don't go looking on his blog, on his website, unless he's posting about it on social, then I'll see it. But I wouldn't. I don't think I would go looking for it.
No, that's interesting, because I probably would create links maybe to that site and say, here's my review, click in, and you go to that site.
Okay, what I learned is in my many, many years in working in communications is we are the laziest people on social media. Really, will we click a link unless you really, really want it? Mm. And that is a golden rule in the day job as well. Mm. When I post things, the golden rule is post native. So if you post links, a vast majority of people won't bother unless they are really invested in it and unless you've really got a hook, and that's copywriting then, you know, and that's a lot of effort has to go in to drive people to a website. But what I do, so for example, on our work Instagram account, there's no point posting news stories on Instagram, no one's interested, but they will love if we break down a news story and post it as stories. So we've got a template of 7 individual Instagram stories, and we pull out quotes that basically just tell you what is in that news story, and do it that way for those who are not ever going to click on that link. And then at the last story that we post is read more, here's the link. Very few people do, but the majority have already seen what that story is about. And then if you're that interested, drive you to...
Well, at the end of the day, I've now got over a year's worth of stuff that nobody's read. So, of course, so if there's another lockdown, then, of course, I can... I mean, there's actually nothing to stop me. I could literally just...
You could just do it.
Because to begin with...
Friday review or... No, Friday film review every week.
Because what I was originally doing is watching the film, coming back to my place, and while something was cooking or a kettle was boiling or whatever, I would do my review. And in those days, I would always read a couple of reviews, like in The Guardian, just to give me something to work against, a counterpoint. It wasn't just me saying, I saw this film, it's the film in context.
Yes.
Read what Peter Bradshaw was writing or something, and if I disagreed with him, then that was a good way to begin the review. But then, of course, it went from being a 200-word review or whatever to being 400 or 500 or 600. And then I now read probably up to a dozen reviews, see what other people think. So it's my review, but it's me playing up off against what other people are saying. So I put a lot of research into it. But part of me sometimes thinks, I want to share this with people, but... Maybe now, maybe through listening to this will
I really hope so, because I watch a lot of it. Go to the cinema every week. Have you seen Violent Night?
I have, more than once.
Oh, really? Yes. You loved it?
I did indeed.
I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. And this is what I love about going to the cinema. I'm a bit of a snob when it comes to films. So I will look at reviews beforehand, and I spend way too much time on IMDb. That's where I go for looking at films and reviews. And I won't see anything that gets reviewed 5 or lower. Sometimes I won't go and see anything that's 6 or lower. Because time's precious, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm quite fussy about what I go and see. But I've also got 2 genres where I will watch absolutely anything, even if they get ear trashed, and they usually are. So I watch a lot of horror films. Way too many horror films. And I watch every Friday, Kung Fu Friday in the house, we watch Kung Fu films. Don't care what they review, don't care if they're dubbed. I mean, I've watched pretty much every Bruceploitation Kung Fu film there is, and they are bilge. Absolute rubbish. I love every second of it. And there's a podcast, and a guy reviews them, and it's not often you hear someone reviewing these really low, low, low budget about a fake Bruce Lee who doesn't look anything like Bruce Lee. And yet there's this little fandom, and I love it. I love connecting into that world. I've never met them, you know. We don't know anything about each other apart from we all like these really crap films.
Now this is really interesting, because I will watch any film, any genre, and I'll review. Except there's a point where, because of the whole Marvel phenomenon, everybody has a view on this. And people will say, oh, you've seen this one, but it doesn't really make sense unless you've seen whichever other one. And there's a lot of things that I'm good at forging those connections myself between films.
Yeah.
And I'll often compare a film to another film from another director, or, you know, a 50-year-old film or whatever it might be. But when the point of reference is another Marvel film, And I'm conscious that I go to the cinema all the time, and then there are people who will only go for Marvel films, or at least suddenly when there's a Marvel film, you know, that they're wearing the T-shirts, the merchandise. And then I'm sort of feeling adrift in not quite my own cinema, but affected because I go there so often. It's sort of my secure environment.
Yeah.
And then there's a part of me that feels, you know, hang on a minute. And I never feel when I'm writing those reviews that I've got the same enthusiasm. And I'm often not sure that I completely get it in that sense. And so that's an interesting one. So that's the one area where I kind of... It was like you.
Yeah.
If I see a film that you know people are not going to see,
yeah,
or maybe a little-known film, even from the 90s or something, then I want to proselytise. I want to tell
people, gosh,
to go and watch it. But I'm not going to do that with Black Panther.
No. And I've stopped going to the cinema to see Marvel films.
Yeah.
Because I just now... They push them out so hard and so fast that I'm bored of it. It is basically the same thing. I've not seen anything new that is interesting me anymore. So I've stopped going and will now prioritise other films. And so, I mean, I love religious horror films. I absolutely adore them. And they are all an absolute load of nonsense.
Pray for the Devil.
Pray for the Devil! Loved Pray for the Devil. And it was so, so horror-light. But I sit there, and because of theology, I am unpicking what this could mean. And because I'm doing digital theology as well, I do it from a point of view of biblical literacy. Because everything I read about biblical literacy in the digital age, our biblical literacy is just dropping. We don't know. And I think we're going to get to a point where the people are only going to know what the cross means because they've seen it in a horror film. And it's like a symbol of good. They won't know any of the other significance because they won't have the Bible and the Christianity and that faith to understand what that symbol means. They're only going to know it from a horror film. For me, that is the most interesting start point for doing theology and biblical literacy. And I pitched this idea in my course at a really, really good mark for it, and they were like, you've got to do it. You've got to do it. And it was basically creating a wiki, because not Wikipedia, but that fan one, which has gone out of my mind now, that Star Trek is on. It's called Memory Prime, is the Star Trek wiki, right? But you can make your own wiki. And I was thinking, just make a whole wiki around horror films and religious horror films, and then spin that off into a podcast, spin that off into Lent courses, spin that off into Advent courses for churches to put on. But actually then, in the podcast, you'd have people like Mark Kermode coming in, because he loves The Exorcist. But partner him up with a theologian, like you, for example, to talk about. And suddenly, you're unpicking from an audience of people who'd be interested from a film point of view, an audience who'd be interested in it from a theology point of view, and you're going to learn something. And I don't think churches are comfortable with horror and horror themes, because I think religion has moved away from embracing sin and negativity or anything like that to being all about personal fulfillment. And you see that through the Bible quotes I shared online from You Bible and all that, which is all about how God makes me feel happy. You know, it's all about that personal fulfillment of faith. And so horror then is too dark a theme to unpick, even though horror is all about good versus evil. That's what it is.
And what is so strange about those films, and actually funny from the point of view of a theologian, is that they have often a very basic theology, but there is a very clear and obvious theology going on in them.
Yeah.
And if we are not dissecting those, then who is? I came across an article a while ago, I think I quoted it in one of my pieces of work, by Marianne Beavis, and she was looking at films like Stigmata.
Oh yeah.
And how they often have, exactly as you just said, they have particular tropes, and they might use the cross, but often they'll use biblical texts, but they're erroneous, or they're fictional biblical texts. I mean, the Pulp Fiction, Ezekiel, yeah.
Yes.
And they'll use those, and people will see those as the point of reference. And so our sense of what's heresy, what's blasphemy, what's orthodoxy, will come from these crazy films.
Yeah, I love it.
And in a way, there's a reason why those films are made, and they're made in the way that they are.
Yeah.
But there needs to be a dialogue.
Absolutely.
And the good thing is, this is not people like us going and saying, oh, you mustn't do it that way because you've overstepped the mark. I love these films. I don't sit there and think, oh, the theology in this is outrageous, I'm going to walk out. I think it's teaching me something.
That's the beauty, I think, where theology is at the moment. Where, and that's why I think social media is fantastic for having dialogue on theology. You know, everyone jokes about Anglican Twitter being like a really pernicious place that's really angry people. But it really could be a really good place that takes theology out of the hierarchy of people who say this is the only way you're allowed to think about it, and puts it into a very public dialogue where I would say junior theologians like me, although calling myself a theologian feels a bit odd, can get involved in that conversation. And if we are open-minded enough, we can learn from people who perhaps see, younger people who see things from a very different point of view. But I don't think we're bold enough as a church to see that, particularly when it comes to horror. Because I think horror, when all the research I've done says, horror films used to be an 18 certificate, you know? They're now 15 or lower, because the research says it's teens going in to the cinema to watch these films. They're the ones that aren't going to church. So they're the ones we should be saying, yeah, talk to us about theology, talk to us about horror.
Do you know, I remember when in 1998, so probably would have been when you were at university when The Exorcist was
in the Lyric in Carmarthen. Did you see The Lyric in Carmarthen?
No, I saw it in Swansea at the UCI.
Oh, I saw it in The Lyric. Tell me your experience on it, I'll tell you mine.
Well, this is the funny thing, because obviously it had such a big history.
Yeah.
And Mark Kermode had obviously been raving about it for years, but it was now properly in the cinemas rather than in those midnight slots.
Yes.
Now, I remember these young boys, obviously 18 rated, and they were very young teenager, if barely teenager, and they sneaked in. They'd obviously bought a ticket for another film.
Yeah.
And then they...
Oh, it's the classic move, isn't it? I love it.
And that's my memory. But this is something I remember. Somebody who was working temporarily in the department in Lampeter. And she'd been... Now, this is interesting. She always made a point of saying that she was, quote, not religious, you know. And it was like, why do you need to be that defensive? But that's fine. Now, she'd been to see the film, and she was judging it entirely as whether it was scary. And I said, it's a brilliant film because blah, blah, blah. And she said, what are you talking about? There's no religion in it. And I was like, I'm sorry. You know, and I was thinking, now what happened? She went to see the film because it was a horror film and it was going to scare or not. So because I was looking through a different lens, that was traipsing on her terrain, because suddenly it's like, oh, he's looking at this for a reason that almost like takes away the validity of my meaning, because this is what the film is. And he's saying it's actually, you know, and he's reading it through a different sort of lens.
Whoa,
and I remember having this huge, bizarre argument. She's actually saying it's not religious. And I'm thinking, you know, then it's one of the sort of, because these days you aren't use the word gaslighting.
Yeah,
it was
like,
well, hang on. And then I started to mention this, and it was a lost cause. Because you know the scene that, well, there's the spider walk.
Yes, because that was for the first time, wasn't it, during that, when that came back in the cinema.
And there was the other scene when Father, it's Karras, isn't it, when, am I right, he sees an image of his late mother, and it's in the subway, walking down the subway, and that was chilling, and what works in The Exorcist so well is the whole religion versus secularism and Ellen Burstyn's character, because you can relate to her, but she's like, I don't know what's going on with my daughter. She knows that there's something that makes no sense. And then when the establishment are saying, oh, it's to do with the temporal lobe, or they're trying to come up with a route with an explanation, she knows, even though she's not a believer, that there's something not in there. So it's a very insightful and very clever film, in a way that perhaps some of the others we've mentioned are not. But my experience then was somebody who was very clear that it was a particular type of film, but seemed to have a problem that it might be possible to have another perspective that could be lent to that.
That's fascinating. Now, my experience of going to see it was, we were all laughing. We didn't find it scary at all. In fact, the entire cinema laughed. The spider bit. Laughter. And I was like, I thought this was the scariest film ever. But nobody was scared. They all laughed. I've seen it a couple of times since, but I watched it the first time when I finished university, watched it here at home, and I was terrified. a very different experience. And that's why I think, going back to Violent Night the other night when I saw it, I've never been in a cinema. Every single person was having the time of their life, laughing out loud, reacting. And it can change your perspective of the film you're watching. And that's what I think is so good about going to the cinema. Even if a film is rubbish, but the audience is having a good time, just get swept away.
Well, a confession to make, and I'm conscious that I'm obviously recording myself in some ways, but there's that scene in Violent Night. Now, in any other context, if you see somebody's face on fire, you obviously wouldn't see that as a moment for laughter. But of course, it's the Christmas tree light. First of all, you think he's been attacked by a Christmas tree. Yeah, you think, yeah, that's funny. But then it catches flame. And then you see his whole face.
I know.
And I watched that with an audience. But I was, I was finding it difficult to suppress a chuckle. But it's the context. But with The Exorcist, I first saw that in, I think it was early 94. It was my last year as an undergraduate. And it was shown on a Sunday night. First time I'd seen it. And a couple of my friends who were also doing theology.
Yeah.
Knew the film, and they were going to have the time of their life. And they were laughing out loud at those very moments that we were talking about. But I was watching, and I found it very creepy. I thought it was quite a menacing
film, and
all of that. But I had the same experience as going to a hypnotist show once, when they were like all having the time of their life, and I was thinking, I don't know what's going on. Somebody's doing something, is this a joke? Is this an act?
Or
are they really possessed?
Yeah.
And with The Exorcist, it really chilled me. But there were some people having the time of their life. So I was watching them watching the film as much as I was watching the film myself. So that was always my point of reference for the film. The fact that I watched that with some theologians who were seeing this as an intensely funny experience.
Wow, fascinating. Yes, yeah, so that's my memory of going to see it. And it's funny seeing it around the same time as you. Have you seen the sequels?
Yes, I've seen a couple of them, and the prequel that, of course, the one that Paul Schrader did, which was not allowed to be released.
No, that's why I can't think what it's called now. I've seen them, I've seen, I thought the second one is hilariously bad, because, I mean, could they have just gone completely over the top? The third one is brilliant, one of the most scary films I've watched. Love the third one. Now, you're a big Brian De Palma fan, aren't you?
Yes.
What is it about Brian De Palma as a director?
Well, what he does, and I think of that famous the lift scene in the Michael Caine film Dressed to Kill, is that he goes all out for it and he notches it up and he doesn't flinch.
No.
So even in a film like Carlito's Way, which is not a horror film, it's something very visceral about what he's trying to do. And he takes a sort of conceit, but he ramps all the way up, goes all the way to the full.
Yeah, I think he is one of my favourites. And I'm always interested about the comparison between him and Hitchcock. Mm. Because I think he's a fantastic director for the very reason you just say, that he really gets either you love his films or you hate them, I think, because they cause such a reaction in you. And I remember watching Carrie for the first time and thinking, this is the most unpleasant film I've ever watched, and I love it, but it's not an easy watch. And you mentioned Carlito's Way, but a lot of his films, even the ones he's doing recently that have not done very well, they still have a big impact. Like Femme Fatale, for example, which didn't do very well, but I can still remember it. You know, it's a very, very memorable director. I think he's great.
And I wonder if it's the comparisons with Hitchcock that were causing people to be a bit sceptical of some of his work, because of course there are homages to Hitchcock. But Dressed to Kill, I remember, got some very poor reviews.
Yeah.
But it's also a very confident, very audacious film. And because it's Michael Caine as well, who completely inhabits that role, and of course there's a big twist or one that you can see coming.
Yeah.
But it's the audacity of it, and I really admired that he wasn't, trying to sort of just give you a hint of something. He kind of took the premise all the way to its conclusion.
Yeah.
And that, for me, and in a way, I'd say he has gone further than Hitchcock ever did.
Oh, I think so. I think, there's a lot... Well, I think Frenzy is one of my favourite Hitchcock films, actually, because I do think he was then getting into some very dark, menacing stuff, but with such sense of humour. And there is some humour, a lot of humour in Brian De Palma stuff, and I think Raising Kane, for example, which, just remind me, I've got to give you the disc, which is over there. I'm going to give you the disc. Back because I watched I watched it the first time and I realised this is the edited version, a different version. And then I realised a few years back they'd released the director's cut edition of it. It's a different film. Completely different. And so I am that completist kind of person where I'll watch it, but I have to have the director's cut then, which is why I buy physical media. And I, you know, walk through the living room and you'll see I've got a ton of discs. Even though they're on streaming, I'll buy the physical media because I love the documentaries and the commentaries. One of my favourite Bruce Lee films, which is a Bruce exploitation film, is Game of Death. Everyone says it's the worst one ever. I love it, but I love it because of the commentary as well. Because the commentary tells you so much about the making of the film and the history of it. And I watch it endless amount of times. So it just brings it a different perspective.
And you just made me think of something, because we mentioned Pray for the Devil. Now, Philip, we mentioned it three times, and that's the total number of critics' reviews, maybe there have only been two, on Rotten Tomatoes. Now, what I found is that the professional reviewers, the sort of the I don't think I'd seen a Mark Kermode review. Certainly Peter Bradshaw didn't review it. Now, I find that intriguing, because it's a film that was showing in all the multiplexes.
Yeah, it was everywhere.
I saw it in Dover, which is a six-screen cinema, and they don't always show all the films that I'd like to watch. So that was showing there, and I thought, well, if it's showing in Dover, then it obviously has a big release. So let me look at the critics' reviews. And I found two or three. So my review of that film is one of, you know, obviously there are, I'm sure people have written their own versions, but it's when I wrote that, and I was looking at other reviews to sort of compare it with, I literally just had a handful. And, you know, compare that to the hundreds or thousands for the Marvel films.
Yeah.
So there's a missed opportunity there.
Absolutely. But also, that Pray for the Devil, the cinema was packed when we were there. And it was a big Halloween release as well. So Halloween Ends had come out, which, I mean, just let's not even go there. I mean, the other two, they did well. Just pointless. But that was Pray for the Devil was a big release, and I went with a priest to see it, and someone who doesn't watch horror films. But I was like, if I go to the cinema, I have to choose. I know that's selfish, but I'm really fussy. I'm not going to waste my time going to see something I don't want to see. So I was like, we're seeing Pray for the Devil. Come if you want or don't. So he was like, oh, I don't know. You know, is it going to be offensive? And I was like, you tell me. And he really enjoyed it for the same reason that he was seeing a lot of theology being played out in this film. So he didn't find it particularly scary, but he found it a really interesting watch. And yeah, that's why I don't worry. People do, even in work, feel it's a bit odd that I love horror films so much. Isn't it anti-Christian? No! It's like the most Christian films ever. They're just not cheesy, like, you know, the stuff you get on Prime or something.
Yeah. And they all have representations of the institutional church.
Oh!
And the idea that there's a conspiracy that's being suppressed. And you saw that in Pray for the Devil. And you saw it in Stigmata, The Exorcist, End of Days with Schwarzenegger. They're all the same. It's this idea of there being an establishment cover-up.
Yeah, absolutely. It really does. There's just so much good conversation to be had about it. I've been reading, because I watched the new Hellraiser film, which is not the best I've seen. It went straight to Prime. But I'm a massive Clive Barker fan, but he is very, very sexual in his horror. He is very, because I love body horror as well, so Cronenberg is my absolute favourite director. I think The Fly is 10 out of 10. I mean, it's visceral, it's hard going, but it's amazing. So I watched Hellraiser, and Hellraiser is one of my favourite horror films, which I've watched probably more than any other film. But it's all about pleasure and pain. And not in a cheap, you know, Jason Kills kind of way, but in a very clever way where they're playing with... And you have to look at the subversity that's going on in the 80s, you know, and you look at the AIDS narrative that's going on, or you look at... how LGBT or alternative communities were being persecuted, and you see this film burst into the cinema, and on one level it's just a really grim horror with chains being ripped off, and another one it's saying something very profound about society. And you can watch these films on two very different levels. I can just switch off and enjoy them, and I love Friday the 13th for that very reason. You're just going to get busty ladies running from Jason and his knife. And you can watch Hellraiser, which gets really bad negative press of being like a video nasty kind of film, or it did back then. And I watch it and I'm fascinated every time I watch them about what that tells us. And I read an article about Hellraiser and they were seeing it from the Sin Eater point of view. And I was like, blown my mind. I'd never even considered that. So I watched it again, having read this.
But often at the end of these films, they'll say who the religious consultant was. Yeah, the Omen is actually. And of course, they'd make a point of saying the Reverend so-and-so, or such a PhD, to show that it's a reputable person.
Yeah, yeah.
But you must be thinking, why not yourself?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Because I think it's a very... It's, because I think we've all... I guess if you're... The people that they would pick would probably go to official channels, wouldn't they? So you're going to get the official view. But then you could pick someone... Like, why not pick someone from a liberation theology point of view? And you'd have a very different perspective about justice and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But you're right, because I've had a few over the years, and hopefully some of them will be listening to this, I've interviewed them in the past, people who want to do PhDs in religion and horror.
Oh.
And that is an area that there's more than one person in just the last few years who has really wanted to follow through on that particular thesis.
But horror films seem to be having a resurgence. The only change that is happening is their rating in terms of, you know, the BFI, not BFI, but the Board of Classification, are being dropped to much lower to get the younger people in. Which I find fascinating that we're not leaning into this and having that conversation. I subscribe to Scream magazine, you know, which is, on. If you see it lying around the house, I look like I'm a warped person to be reading horror magazines. But I love it because there's a really subversive community and the horror, and I love folk horror as well, so I read a lot of folk horror. Adam Neville is my favourite horror author. He did The Ritual, which I still think is the most superb British horror film I have seen in recent years. It is right up there with The Wicker Man. And The Wicker Man scared the hell out of me.
Yeah. But not the sequel with with Nicolas Cage riding his bicycle.
Oh, Nicolas Cage. I mean, how's that? Oh, honestly, yeah. I don't get him. But he's still tuned to now, and people still love him. What can you say now?
Well, as we start to wrap up, I've got a few more questions for you, Matt. I mean, would you say your memories, as you survey your life and career, are predominantly positive ones?
That's a good one. Do you know, if you asked me that 5 years ago, I'd say yes, but I've had cancer. And so I look back on the last 5 years and really with such anger. It stalled my career. It knocked my confidence. First time I really had to deal with depression. You know, I spent about a week where I was like, I couldn't get out of bed. And you'd think, you know, it wasn't like stage four or anything. It was stage one testicular cancer. But, oh my God, do people not understand what it's like? So I look back on the last 5 years, not particularly amazing. The last three has been amazing in terms of recovery, and new job, new outlook, more relaxed me, I think. But I don't think I look back on the last few years as being the best I've ever had, mainly because I overshadowed it a hell of a lot.
No, and that's completely understandable because, I mean, I always find that those reflective questions, I mean, they're fine when you're looking at like 20, 30 years ago, because you can sometimes in your life sort of say, okay, that's where I was then, but my perspective has changed.
Yeah.
But when you're of a certain age, and then you're going through something that is obviously very debilitating, then of course that's going to wreak havoc with your sense of what journey am I on, where am I going, where am I headed, can I still go there, am I being stalled? And COVID obviously came along around that whole period, and that would have been another kind of barrier. But because I'm always interested in this notion about whether, you know, negative experiences, you know, can you be nostalgic about something negative? How do you deal with it? And there never is a right or wrong answer because it has to be the lens through which that you're looking at it.
I don't know. Does nostalgia always have to be positive?
Well, it's bittersweetness, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's a weird thing to say, but I look back now and I'm not grateful for the experience because I'm still angry about it. But I have changed completely because of it. I think I'm just a calmer person. I'm a lot more laid back. I used to be really tense, and I used to worry and carry so much guilt if I'd let someone down or upset someone. Whereas once you face something like as life-changing as that, I think you just put a lot of things into perspective. And now after that, there are people in my life that I'm not friends with from that period because they didn't, not that they didn't understand, or they thought I had changed, so I wasn't the same person. And then I think, well, we don't get on now. And mainly that is to do with going out and being that party, that I don't have that energy. And actually, it's not the biggest part of my life anymore. So I've parked that, and I know there was a fair few people who didn't like the way I changed because of that. And I'm happier for it. So I've lost a few friends along the way because of it. But I think I'm probably a better person having gone through it. Before cancer, I would have looked back on my life as being absolutely amazing. I mean, I was disabled, so I've got a 90-degree curve in my spine, so I wore a brace, scoliosis. So school on the whole was fine. You'd think being disabled in the 80s and 90s, you'd have, you know, your head would be down the toilet every day. But I think I got a free pass for some reason. I don't know why. So school was pretty good. I didn't have a lot of friends. I got more friends going to university than I did. But that's mainly because I probably was suddenly realised I'd come out. And that's a massive load off your shoulders. And you're in university and no one seemed to care. Mm. It's like a different world, isn't it, when you're in university?
Well, it is. And it's like a like-minded, a world where suddenly, particularly in my case in Lampeter, because it's an arts and humanities place.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always used to joke that, you know, we were the people who never really did sciences at school, never enjoyed sciences at school. So there was always something. We all came from different places, but we had so much in common that we were in this refuge, really, in a small Welsh town in West Wales, where all the other people were, you know, in many cases from different countries, different continents. And it was kind of it wasn't a microcosm of the real world.
No.
But it's a microcosm of the world that we wanted.
Yeah, that's spot on. Yeah. It was the most safest place to be, to become who I am, to become the man I am now. That's why I look back on those 3 years. And as I say, there are albums I remember listening to, and I can remember what was going on in my life right now. Chumbawamba was the song I came out in. I mean, you know, I'd love to have a far better coming out story than that. But on the dance floor, in I think it was Harvey's or Metro's, that comes on, and that was the coming out song. It's bonkers, isn't it? Yeah. But that was, it is a microcosm of the relationships and the friendship I've always wanted. And it happened in 96 to 99 in Carmarthen. And so I've got such fond memories of that place.
Yeah.
And I'm too scared to go back.
Yeah, and that's completely understandable because a lot of friends I know don't want to go back to Lampeter because they're aware that there's a Lampeter in their memory and they don't want that to be distorted.
Yeah.
I might have thought that at one point, but also, and it may be because I've got such copious records of that period, in a way that's never good. That period is kind of embodied.
That's a good point.
It's kind of concretized. But that's maybe because that's my safety valve. So maybe I've created.
Oh yeah.
You know, so I could go there and find it the most horrible place in the world. But it kind of doesn't matter because the Lampeter that I knew is there in many manifestations.
That's a really good point. Actually, I think I don't know. Maybe I'm getting older and I would be a little bit more relaxed about going. But I was so I'm so precious about that time. It meant so much to me, and even more so now because my best friend Matthew from that time died last year of stage 4 cancer, and it was really hard because he was the first of our friends to die, you know. And it's a really hard thing to suddenly look back on your photos that you used to laugh at, and now we look back on them and I'm like, I really miss him, you know. So those, it is now bittersweet to look back on that time, but all of us have said, God, could you imagine him not being in our lives? That would have been the worst. Well, you wouldn't know, but I went to his funeral, and me, Kat were there, and we were the closest one of his friends. And you know, we're in his funeral at the same time, crying, at the same time, laughing at some of the stuff he did. Yeah. You know, I'm glad it happened at this stage of my life because I can not let it affect me so much. I think. Previously, I wonder if it would have been more triggering for me. Yeah. But having gone through it myself and being a lot more calm and relaxed, I look back and I feel comfortable to be able to talk about it. I feel comfortable about smiling even though he's not around. You know, I'm not sure I would have had that before. Yeah. I would have wallowed in it.
An awful lot. No, and a lot of people, don't they, say that funerals can be in some ways joyous occasions because obviously the person has died, which is the most horrible thing, but that person brought so much joy.
Yeah.
And that's the thing to mark, that's the thing to celebrate. That's the, if you associate that person with joy, then make the funeral joyous.
Yeah.
Rather than because if that person was never melancholy, if that person never brought anything negative into your life until now that they've gone, then in a way you kind of feel that it doesn't quite, it wouldn't, it's not a bespoke funeral.
Absolutely. Yeah,
I've interviewed somebody who's a theologian who works in a funeral home up in Durham.
Wow.
I interviewed her a few years ago, and she was talking about how they've had funerals with people like juggling balls because that's what the person was.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. I love it. I know, and I think you're right. Funerals should be a celebration, and I think I do wonder if people aren't having church funerals like they are anymore. They're having like humanist funerals because we've somehow, the church has cornered the market on being seen as being a bit mournful and down, when actually we can own that space of it being a celebration. It doesn't have to be, you have to have it outside a church. I had a great time at his funeral because we caught up with people and had a really good laugh. Yeah. And it was really special.
Yeah.
Really special. Yeah,
and you see the communities that have been brought into being because of that person, that you wouldn't be there. People that you're with, the common denominator is that person.
That one person. We all shared the most hilarious stories. And, you know, and there's parts of me that was like, oh, these are the parts of his life I don't know about because he'd got friends when he was in school. Mm-hmm. But it's just wonderful. And here's a really good story just to bring it full circle about film. He and I, if we didn't go out on a night out in Carmarthen, would go down to Regent's Videos, if you remember Regent's, and rent the worst crispy looking films. And by crispy, they have to look like, when you put them in, the tracking goes like that. So we rented the dreadful films like The Refrigerator, which was a horror film about a demonic fridge. I know, I mean, only in straight to video VHS land do you get that kind of nonsense. We watched all the Nightmare on Elm Street, but like the really crispy versions, like the sound goes all. So horrors is nostalgia as well for me, because we watched, name me a horror film, we would have, if Regent's Video had it, we rented it. Yeah. And I love the smell of smoke, stale smoke on the videos.
Yeah.
You know, these videos had been passed through hundreds of customers' hands before landing in ours.
No.
It was fascinating.
And that is because sometimes I like to watch a film now that's in even more pristine condition than when I first saw it.
Yeah.
Obviously with Blu-ray or
oh, because it's like watching a different film.
Yeah, it is. But what you're saying is that those days, those analogue days, are actually precious in themselves.
Oh,
rather than look back and say, oh, we used to watch really bad quality stuff. I mean, like VHS, I agree. I mean, you'd watch them in the wrong form.
Oh, pan and scan.
Yeah. I mean, I used to buy pan and scan. I remember I bought Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
And they said, do you want the widescreen version or pan and scan? Oh, I'm sure they didn't call it pan and scan. And I said, well, of course the pan and scan, because otherwise it won't fill the screen. I wouldn't do that now.
No, of course, I know.
And now that, of course, the TVs have now adapted, and of course and at the cinemas as well, obviously, you're used to the sort of the widescreen mode. But that was just the culture back in the early 90s.
I miss renting films, because as kids, we used to rent films from Dukes of Hazzard in Bridgend, which was the Beta Barn. You go get the Betamax videos from. Or Tremaine's. I got such fond memories of going to video stores and renting things. Then it was Blockbuster. But I still rent. I rent online. Not streaming, but there's something called Cinema Paradiso, where they send you discs in the post, like Blockbuster used to. And because I love it, it's exciting. I just put a load of films on the list, I forget about it, until I get an email reminder you need to refresh your list. And whatever turns up, I'll watch. Yeah. I got two on their way. One of them is Return of Salem's Lot. I mean, it's probably going to be rubbish. I don't care. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to enjoy it.
But also, there are some things, and music can be the same, and they're quality proof. Mm. Because there are things that we associate with our childhood sometimes that, I mean, my own children will sometimes say, God, that sounds awful, Daddy, or something. And I think, but it doesn't matter, because that was 1981.
Yeah.
I might be, you know, I was probably the age that my children are
now.
And it doesn't matter whether it's rubbish or not. I mean, what's the standard of rubbish? I grew up with this in my DNA.
Yeah.
I actually am not capable of dissociating myself from that. Whereas I might listen to the music that is out now, and I might think, oh, this has got nothing to do with me. I don't, you know, I'm turned into my parents.
Yes. Oh, gosh.
Oh, it was better in my day.
Saying, yeah, I don't get Taylor Swift. I don't get it, but everyone's loving it. Yeah. But with films, you know, I love Superman 4, Quest for Peace. It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible, but I love it because I remember being so excited as a kid to have watched it. And yes, I knew it wasn't very good at the time, but I didn't care because it was a new Superman film. Same with Superman 3. Everyone, which you read the reviews, say it's a dreadful film, and it was just Richard Pryor's film, not Superman film. And as a kid, I didn't see that. I just saw Superman turning evil. That's genius. You know, and I watched it for hours on end. I love Grease 2. Yeah. Everyone tells me it's rubbish. It's not. I've been to see it on stage. I bought this. Honestly, if I like something, it's an obsession. Mm. And I go full hilt into it as well. I like Supergirl. And they over in the UK, they hadn't released a decent copy of it. So I bought, you know, an import from America because I had to see this version that had something cut out. I get way too obsessed about this stuff.
We're kindred spirits.
Oh, gosh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, would you have thought years and years ago when you were in school and you were talking about some of these experiences, I mean, could you have imagined that you'd be doing what you're doing now?
Oh, no way. I mean, I never had a career plan. I wanted to be a detective, but that's only because I liked Sherlock Holmes films, and I loved this Sherlock Holmes Granada TV programme. It scared me, but I loved it. And then I realised you have to be a policeman, and I was like, oh, you didn't fancy that. I'll think of something else. But I think it was doing theology and doing RE, and it was probably the lectures I had, because I look back and they all inspired me in some way of, oh, this is a brilliant subject, and I love it, and I never lost it. And now I work for the church, and it's amazing. But it was never planned, but those seeds were sown when I went to Catholic Church, and just loved the bells and smells of it all. And I think that's nostalgia, probably, because, you know, if I didn't have that, I'd have a different form of church, but I have this, and I look back, and I loved going to church on a Sunday. I loved the smell. I can remember the smell of my mum's lipstick. Weirdly, I know that's a weird thing, but it was a big deal to go to church. You know, you dressed up for it. And I can remember her perfume as well. I can remember the incense. I can remember what it was like in church. And I think part of me thinks going to church and going for these high Anglo-Catholic churches is part of that nostalgia factor that I love so much, because it takes me back to a very serene, peaceful Matthew that was as a kid, and I loved it.
Well, I've got the next question segs perfectly, my final question segs perfectly from what you've just said, which is whether you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Do you know what? I was thinking about this walking to meet you today, thinking, I don't like nostalgia. I don't know if we're going to have a good conversation about it. And talking to you now, realise just how much joy I get from looking back and relating it to the now. I don't know. Do you think I'm nostalgic?
Everything that you've said, completely. What you've done, you've been very good at both enjoying the reminiscing of what happened in your life, but also aware of different times and places. I mean, actually full on. I mean, what you have done is embrace particular parts of your life that you knew were significant. And you've kind of eulogised them. You watch films now.
Yeah.
And, you know, the films that you might have seen in the 90s or earlier. And as you said, they may not have been critically well received, but that you want to promote them.
Yeah.
So that actually is a very, because it's related to that, it's integral to who you are. So I'd say from everything you've said to me here that you are hugely nostalgic.
I think I am, and I don't think I think I've always been too scared to say I am, because I think I'm so scared of being held back. I'm scared of not advancing myself, because I think I'm on the cusp of, I could make my life so much easier if I just coasted, you know, and just be comfortable being maybe a bit plain Jane Superbrain, you know, as a nostalgia for you.
Neighbours, 1987.
Neighbours, 1987, yeah, exactly. But I don't. I have a fear of standing still. And so I push myself and I put myself under way too much pressure. Why am I doing a master's and working full-time, Chris? Why? I mean, and why am I now writing articles for like Practical Theology Journal and all this kind of stuff? Because I put myself, I have to keep moving forward. I get scared if I think I'm looking back and not advancing myself.
Well, I've obviously made a very smart career move then, because I now, nostalgia is, I've made a whole future of it.
Exactly, exactly. But now I think after this conversation, I feel like way more comfortable about being nostalgic. I'm actually, it's really quite fun talking about...
It is a form of therapy, I think.
It, 100% is a form of therapy, but I'm in a much better place mentally to be able to deal with it. I don't think I would have been a few years ago at all.
Well, I think this has been a tremendous...
No, thank you. This has been a joy.
Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you very much, and lovely to see you again after all these years. Yeah.